KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond.
Outer Sunset.
Hey, I'm from Foster City.
Alameda.
Coming up, the city of Richmond turns abandoned homes into assets.
The houses just become these black holes for money.
Then a new film tackles the racist history of home ownership in the U.S.
The government would insure loans in certain areas and not in others. And so it was all based on this perception that having black families in your neighborhood would bring values down.
And we hear about one Hunter's Point adult who's making a very specific kind of difference for graduating high school seniors.
I was raised without a dad, and so I know what I was put here for, and it was like for these kids.
That's all coming up next on Cross Currents. Even in the Bay Area, there are some properties that are so dilapidated they can't sell. Many have been languishing since the foreclosure crisis a decade ago. But instead of letting them just take up space, the city of Richmond is flipping the homes that investors won't touch. They're buying the properties with money from a bond passed in 2015, working with nonprofits to renovate them, and then providing low-interest loans to low-income buyers. Journalist J.P. Dobrin filmed one woman's experience with the program for the local news outlet Richmond Confidential. According to Dobrin, 5 homes have been completed through this bond-funded program, and about 30 more are in the works. He spoke with KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal about this creative approach to keeping low-income people housed in Richmond.
There's several hundred abandoned properties in Richmond, and what are the risks or costs associated with that for the city?
Right. Yeah. They, you know, the houses kind of just become these black holes for money. You know, a simple abandoned home just leads to millions of dollars in cost to a city. And just code enforcement alone identified that they spend $7,000 a year on a property only to maintain it, which means, like, you know, cutting back the weeds, you know, boarding up the windows and doors and entryways and things like that. Once a property becomes abandoned and people see that in the neighborhood, people start illegally dumping trash, which is a huge problem in the city of Richmond and Oakland as well. And something that I mentioned in the piece is that there's been quite a few number of fires in Richmond of these abandoned properties recently. And it's due to people squatting and, you know, not having heat and maybe setting things on fire. So when you take into consideration the, you don't have a homeowner in there who's paying property taxes, and, lowering the property values of homes in a neighborhood and for the, for the adjacent neighbors, and having their property values, diminished is really, really unfortunate. And so that's why they were so desperate to partner with nonprofits to do something about these, you know, quote unquote zombie properties that happen when they become abandoned and blighted.
So it's too expensive, or it's not profitable for private real estate interests mm-hmm. to buy these buildings mm-hmm. and flip them themselves mm-hmm. on the private market. And that's because prices are not high enough to make that profitable in Richmond.
Yeah, I mean, the properties become unprofitable because they become in, you know, various stages of just utter disrepair. And, you know, they rack up, you know, thousands of dollars in fines from the city for various reasons. And so when you add kind of those two costs together, that I think is a big barrier for them to be flipped quickly. And some of the agencies in Richmond kind of expressed frustration in dealing with the banks because the banks do not provide any sort of maintenance on the property at all when it gets to a certain point of it being blighted.
Okay, so can you tell me the story of this house that you feature in the video and the woman that we meet?
Yeah, so the house belongs to Susan Wiseman, and it's her original family home that she grew up in. And I think it sat abandoned for over a decade after her mother died without a will.
And did you get any other information about the backstory about why this home wasn't being lived in by this family? Like why it fell into disrepair the way it did?
Yeah, I did. So after Wiseman's mother passed away very suddenly, Susan Wiseman's brother started living in the home, and he was on drugs, and I think he was basically a negligent homeowner. he set fire to the home accidentally, I believe in the garage area. And so, you know, I don't think they kept up with whatever payments or taxes to the city. And so he ended up essentially squatting in their original family home. And from my understanding, talking with other officials in the city, this is a pretty common occurrence.
So we have this house that sat abandoned for a decade. And what happened? What does the city of Richmond decide to do with that house?
So the house that you see at the end of the video is basically the positive kind of result of this program that's happening, where it's a house that's been acquired by the city, it's been renovated, and, you know, they've identified a, you know, low-income first-time home buyer to purchase the home. And in this case, it happens to be the original, one of the original family members who used to live there.
This is pretty awesome. This is pretty awesome. Mom's house. Never in a million years. I would say hallelujah. This is it. Back at home.
Yeah, so the city was able to put up the money to renovate it and sell it back. Did she have any feelings, Susan Wiseman, of like, I have to buy back my own family home? Like, that wasn't in the movie, but I feel like that would be sort of something that I would feel.
Yeah. She kind of expressed a little bit of resentment of how much the home actually costs this day today, because the way the program works is that they do price the home to be, you know, marketed, at the current market rate. And so I think she was just had a little bit of a sticker shock of how much her home cost.
But she does get the help of the low interest loan, right? And she doesn't have to pay all those costs of making the place habitable again.
You know, I think the program is really innovative and fantastic, you know, in the sense that they are providing, you know, actual tangible financial assistance to people who are looking to buy a home. And, you know, with how expensive the San Francisco Bay Area is, it's, I think for certain people, it's just unattainable without that additional support.
That was Richmond Confidential reporter J.P. Dobrin talking to KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal. You can reach Liza at housing@KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. The history of home ownership in the U.S. is a complicated one, but a look at that history can help shed light on why today's housing economy is the way it is, especially if you go back to post-World War II America. The new film, Owned, A Tale of Two Americas, explores the overtly racist housing policies of the mid-20th century that led to two contrasting realities, white middle-class suburban life and Black and Latino segregation and disenfranchisement. The film plays tonight at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco as part of the San Francisco Documentary Festival. Director Giorgio Angelini joined me in studio to talk about the post-war policies that shaped what housing would look like for generations to come.
So post-war housing, you've got millions of veterans coming back home from the war, and there's a huge housing shortage. And you also got this massive war machine that was building boats and planes and just all the war machinery that are now basically turned off. Mm-hmm. But we still had all this capability. So the idea was that, well, why don't we use that sort of know-how and do it into fabricating homes? William Levitt was an enterprising developer there, and he decided to sort of create this huge, the first tract home project there, and called it Levittown.
So that was the first suburb?
I mean, in the first post-war suburb, where you sort of had this confluence also, the other important factor, which was that the government created through the GI Bill a huge subsidy for people to come out and buy homes basically with interest-free mortgages with very little money down. And on the other side, they were also facilitating financing for the developers themselves. So it was a huge heavy hand of the government that created this kind of housing.
So returning GIs, what would they get access to?
They would get access to sub-market loans with, you know, very little money down, if not
like $100 in some cases?
Yeah, exactly.
And was this everyone? all the GIs?
Well, as I started doing my research there, there was a really striking moment touring the town with Jimmy Silvestri. He's a retired New York, Nassau County police officer. And he's giving me a tour around talking about how great the city is and how it's the backbone of America and the blue-collar American dream, which it is. But as we turn this corner, he kind of wistfully, solemnly looks out in the distance and says, as great as Levittown is, there's just one thing wrong.
The only thing that Levitt did that was wrong, and I'll be the first one to admit this, no blacks allowed. No blacks allowed. And that is disgraceful.
No blacks allowed. And there was just a hush in the car. And it was so profound.
If I'm fighting alongside a black man who's willing to die for his country, and he can't buy a house next to me in Levittown, I'm sorry, man, that don't make any sense to me.
And I don't know, it was like, once I heard him say that, you could feel that sort of guilt very palpably in all of his friends, because they all have, another discovery that was really interesting for me was that all of them had a very similar story. Hmm. They all came from neighborhoods that we now consider to be historically black neighborhoods in New York, which were not the case. They were living in Bed-Stuy, South Bronx, Brownsville. They were all very integrated neighborhoods before the war. And then after the war, and once the GI Bill kicked in, all these white families were plucked out of these neighborhoods and taken out to the suburbs. And so Jimmy's story really, in many ways, is a story of an unfortunate story of America and how concentration of poverty and segregation and housing really took place.
So was it that the developments accepted no blacks, or was it the GI Bill, or was it both? Where did that happen?
It was through a combination of things. I mean, there was racially exclusive covenants. There were zoning laws. There was redlining. But it was, most famously redlining, which basically meant that the government would insure loans in certain areas and not in others. And so it was all based on this perception, basically, that having black families in your neighborhood would bring values down. And so the government trying to sort of spur this homeownership society and creating a middle class through homeownership inherently wanted to sort of retain values. So they bought into this ideology that was obviously very racist, and it sort of extrapolated in 1,000 different terrible ways.
What is probably a surprise to a lot of people is that redlining is created by the federal government.
Michael, what's redlining?
That's when the white bankers draw red lines around black areas and don't give up no green.
The bank turned down our loan. They said I'm a bad risk.
Why would they say that?
Banks take up that same practice. They decide they're not going to lend in those areas.
That meant that all these benefits that were flowing to potential homeowners were flowing to whites and not flowing to minorities. It baked this element of racism into our homeownership culture.
It ain't their problem, it's our problem. These people are stepping up in life and we're moving down. How much do you think our property's gonna be worth with them living two doors away?
That's a clip from the film Owned, A Tale of Two Americas. With me is filmmaker Giorgio Angelini. And in that clip also, we heard from Nicole Hannah Jones, New York Times journalist, on redlining. Do you find that you were surprised by this history?
Absolutely, just how overt it was, but even more surprised how little we really understand about it. And so we have a history here that is really misunderstood. And if we don't really reckon with the fact that certain people got to certain places for particularly nasty reasons, you're never going to look at what progress means in the right way. Because, to deviate slightly, I think, interestingly, the Archie Bunker clip, looking back on it now, he sounds a lot like, a typical Donald Trump supporter today, I would say. He sees himself as the victim of integration. Black people are moving up in the world, he says, and I'm struggling.
Housing is affecting all aspects of life right now in San Francisco. We have a housing crisis. Do you see any parallels to any of the places that you studied in the film in terms of demographics as well. San Francisco and Oakland losing a lot of black families and black people moving outwards.
Yeah.
Gentrification.
For sure. I mean, I think what's interesting about San Francisco is that these same issues that you know, people of color have been dealing with for many years is now happening to middle-class white people in San Francisco. And I think that is something very interesting. And you know, I think that the thing that's unique about San Francisco, again, like I mentioned, is just that just the physical barriers of it. And so there, then it becomes like a government issue about how to handle that on a zoning and like building policy level.
What do you want people to get out of the film?
People will inherently want to feel defensive when they watch this film, some people. And I feel like I want people to really think hard about how it is they got to where they are and what they can do to ameliorate these problems today.
Why did you select Levittown to live?
We were looking for a place to buy a home. We looked at Levittown, and we liked the homes here. We liked the advantages that Levittown seemed to offer in comparison to other cities. And we understood that it was going to be all white, and we were very happy to buy a home here.
That's Giorgio Angelini, director of the new film Owned, A Tale of Two Americas. The film shows tonight at 9:30 at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco as part of the San Francisco Documentary Festival. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. One caring teacher can make a huge difference in the life of a high school student. But adults outside of school can also have a big impact. And if it takes a village to raise a child, then 74-year-old Walter Turner is one important villager. Walter has got plenty to do, but he spends a ton of time giving back to San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point community where he grew up. And prom season is always busy for him. Education reporter Lee Romney brings us the story.
I think that might be it there.
There he is.
There's a crowd outside high school senior Keontae Jones's house when Walter pulls up in his white Rolls Royce, a 1989 silver spur with a vinyl top the color of peanut butter.
Hey, this is you all day long. I was like, you probably watched it twice today.
Oh, yeah, got it all fixed up, you know?
Yep, it's looking good, man.
An old friend of Walter's, another longtime youth advocate named JT, is here too.
Man, Walt's always had one of the smoothest cars in the neighborhood. I need a PM. I got to get a picture of this one.
Keontae's beaming mom's also got a camera.
Good.
Hey. Keontae's wearing a white suit with white satin pinstripes and turquoise shoes.
Right, right now, it's all about you, Keontae. Looking smooth, man.
Oh, yeah, he looked real good, too, you. Man. He looked real good.
All right.
Yeah, we're on our way.
Keontae's 17. He's graduating from George Washington High, and he'll be headed to Cal State Sacramento in the fall. He plans to major in business.
When JT told me, I said, whoa, Walter got a Rolls Royce? I called him right away.
He's going solo.
All the girls at my high school mostly have boyfriends, so mostly I just go solo. Just dress up real nice, have a good time with your friends.
Keontae gets on the phone to meet up with a friend for a pre-prom dinner.
Hold on, man. I'll call you back when I know what's called.
And he's clearly proud of his smooth ride and his driver.
My chauffeur is driving me there. Yes, I do.
When we get to the restaurant, Keontae reaches for the door, but Walter stops him, because that's what chauffeurs do.
Don't touch the door, man. Don't touch the door. I got it.
Walter goes all out for these prom rides. He's wearing a black tuxedo and a handsome black cap.
I do it because I want them to know that this is what they deserve. You know, they worked for it, and that's what they should get. You know? It's just like if they would have had a bunch of money and running a limo, all that comes with the limo. So why don't come with my services?
After Keontae's done eating, we head to the Hyatt Regency for prom. Keontae gets out of the car in the hotel driveway.
Yeah, just call me.
He's pretty psyched.
Oh, I'm so ready. It's my last dance as a senior. I'm so ready. Have a fun time.
Yeah, I'll just wait around.
So who is tonight's chauffeur, Walter Turner? Well, for decades, his whole identity was built on being an entertainer. He helped create the R&B duo Robert Winters and Fall. Their big hit was Magic Man.
I was Fall with Robert Winters.
Oh, Robert. Sing to me, baby.
At the age of 5, he got polio. And a year later, they found the cure for it.
I can pull a rabbit out of a hat.
It was a year too late. But his legs didn't stop him.
I'm your magic man. Yes, I am.
His partner was also a lifelong friend.
Me and him went everywhere. We did everything. We fell off stages together. Laid there and laughed, you know. But he was the greatest singer in the world. I'm telling you.
Magic man, won't you let my magic pay?
The name of their hit song is tattooed on Walter's neck.
For memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we sold 122,000 copies in New York City alone. Yeah, he passed in 89.
The music industry had been good to Walter. But with his singing partner, Robert Winters, gone, he settled back into his Hunters Point neighborhood to grow his family. He's got 11 kids and 23 grandkids. And he became a homegrown philanthropist. The name of his organization?
Parents Who Care. You know, and I started that 27 years ago. Because I was raised without a dad. You know, he left when I was 5. And so it's just a thing that, like, I know what I was put here for, and it was like for these kids.
Doing work like this at Paul Revere School.
Some of the kids were having problems, and they didn't know what the problems stemmed from.
Except that many of them seemed to be having trouble seeing the board. So Walter and a friend took the kids to Costco to get their eyes examined.
It was like 11 of them needed glasses. So we got glasses for all 11 kids.
Another time, Walter won the San Francisco 49ers Community Quarterback Award for his work with youth. It was $10,000.
I got a list from the schools on who wasn't going to have a good Christmas. And me and my buddy Pete, we went shopping. Spent the whole $10,000.
Walter is also a juvenile justice commissioner for San Francisco County, overseeing conditions for incarcerated kids. So what about the fancy cars? That's just a passion. He got his first Rolls-Royce, a yellow Silver Shadow, in about 2001. But it wasn't really for him.
I bought these for the kids over here because I grew up over here. You know, I've been in this community here for 61 years. And it was like I just wanted to put them on the same playing field with all the other schools. You know, they did just as much and just as well as them to get out of school, you know, to graduate.
So Walter got the word out.
So I told the principals that if they had a kid that wasn't able to go to prom or get a tuxedo or get a gown, you know, to let my organization know. And so they did.
One of Walter's favorite memories is of driving some kids to prom at the Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park.
And it was like a long line of stretch limos, right? And then we pulled up.
In the white Rolls Royce.
And all the heads was turning, right? I enjoyed doing it. And I'll do it again and again and again.
But there's one thing about prom night that all chauffeurs know. There's a lot of waiting. We have 4 hours to kill after we drop off Keontae. Walter heads to a soul food restaurant in Dogpatch.
I knew the lady that showed them how to cook. Yep, now they have lines out the door around the corner. I want the spicy chicken, red beans and rice, and yams.
Then we drive around, taking in some sights on Market Street.
Look at him, just like Michael Jackson.
Mostly, though, we sit in the car outside prom. Walter walks across the street to the 7-Eleven for a lottery scratcher.
Nothing, all losers.
He's not used to staying up this late. He's got church in the morning. But when the kids start streaming out, Keontae's grinning.
Oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Everybody had a good time. I'm tired, though. That dancing got to me.
The Rolls Royce was a hit.
When we came to my prom, they took pictures. And when we left, they took pictures. So, yeah, they're going to remember this Rolls Royce.
They're going to remember you graduating and your prom that you went to.
Yep.
That's the big thing.
That's what Walter wants Keontae to be celebrated for. In San Francisco, I'm Lee Romney for Cross Currents.
Lee is our education reporter. You can reach her at education@klw.org. And that's our show for today. Our team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Janae Darden, Zoe Ferrigno, Angela Johnston, Emma McAvoy, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Shea, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kinsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.